Hello and welcome to the History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and if you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the programme, go to nearpodcast.org/pcast/. I'm joined as always by my co-presenter John Dorney from the IrishStory.com website. This week we are very pleased to be joined by Professor David Fitzpatrick of Trinity College Dublin. Professor Fitzpatrick has edited a new collection of essays by the Trinity History Workshop and published by Lilliput Press called Terror in Ireland, 1916-1923. Professor Fitzpatrick, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
One of the first questions raised by the book is, what is terrorism and how do we define it?
Well, we've applied a very broad definition of terror and terrorism, embracing terror, a climate of fear being created by any source, whether it's the state or paramilitaries, Republican, Loyalist or otherwise. So we don't suggest that it's coming in any particular direction. Our concern is the ways in which fear was aroused among particularly civilian populations and minorities who were affected by the extraordinary events of the revolutionary period.
What would you say about some people who would define terrorism as strictly non-state actors, wouldn't take into account, say, for example, the use of terror by a state while prosecuting a war, trying to suppress a rebellion?
Well, I think it's not up to historians to make judgments of a moral character, condemning or accepting particular forms of terrorism. That's why we prefer to take an ecumenical approach, leave it up to the reader to make the moral judgments. And instead, what we've tried to do is to establish the conditions under which various parties found it necessary to use terror, try to explain why that happened and what the consequences were for those affected by it.
Hi, David. John Dorney here.
Hello, John.
Do you think that there's an objective definition of terrorism? I mean, in conflicts, people always call the other side terrorists as a term of abuse. But is there an objective difference between, say, conventional warfare, guerrilla warfare, and what we call terrorism, do you think?
I don't think there's an objective difference, particularly when we're looking at unofficial wars where people differed fundamentally about whether a war was going on or not. It's extremely important to avoid that sort of judgment. So in this book, we have chapters which look at the use of terror by the state, say in the reprisals which occurred in Balbriggan, where Ross O'Mahony and myself have both written accounts of the way in which civilians were punished and their interests damaged in September 1920, following the killing of two policemen. But we also have accounts of the effects of terror conducted by Republican paramilitaries in County Cork, in both Dunmanway and Kilmichael. And some of that terror was directed, it is argued, specifically against Protestants. So we're looking at many different ways in which terror was applied and many different communities and groups which suffered from it.
When we think of wars, we tend to think of some violence as being legitimate in a war. We think of combatant against combatant. Do you think something becomes terrorism when it targets non-combatants? Is that the crucial difference?
I think that terror can actually be applied to combatants as well as non-combatants. For example, in Jane Leonard's account of the killings of Bloody Sunday morning, the 21st of November 1920 in Dublin, you're looking at terror specifically directed against the persons believed to be intelligence agents. As she shows, less than half of those killed appear, in fact, to have been intelligence officers. But that's a case where you have a very specific group targeted. And the aim of that is a rational aim. It is to strike fear into all of those who might think of providing intelligence on behalf of the state. But I think that's less... terror directed against combatants, particularly armed combatants, doesn't usually work very well, because combatants are in a position to some extent to defend themselves, to build barricades, to retreat into encampments where they can't easily be attacked. And so most terror in these informal wars that we're talking about in the case of Ireland 1916-23, most terrorists are in fact relatively vulnerable and undefended civilians.
Some of the essays in the book deal not just with violence but also with harassment and intimidation. What effect do you think this had on local populations?
Well, I think the effect of intimidation, of social ostracism, of threats and menaces is probably greater. It has a wider and devastating effect than actual killing. Killing's the tip of the iceberg, and relatively few people were killed in the Irish Revolution when you think of other European conflicts of the period. I don't know to what extent particular populations were actually driven out of Ireland as a result of terror. My own feeling is that because Irish populations, Catholic and Protestant, over so many centuries have got used to intimidation and menace, that they've become extraordinarily resilient. And although you'll have people fleeing their districts, a good many of them would come back again pretty quickly and settle into roughly the same environments and culture that they had left. And an example of that would be something we don't discuss in the book, unfortunately, because we had no contributors associated with Trinity College who could participate in the workshop. But that is the way that Catholic workers from the shipyards and engineering works in Belfast in a series of expulsions, 1920, 21, 22, and so on, they go back fairly quickly after the horrible period of arson and destruction has taken place. Now, some never went back, but there's more resilience than one would suspect on the basis of the propaganda put out by all sides.
When we think about Irish political violence, I think if you look at the 19th century and you look at the Fenian movement, you can see kind of two strands of thinking about political violence. In 1867, the Fenians are very concerned that they look like legitimate combatants, that they fight openly. But there's also a tradition which we associate with the Land League, or before that with secret societies, which is more to do with intimidation and nighttime raids and anonymous killings. And I think in the War of Independence, you can see continuities with both of those ideas. Would you agree there?
I think that's a very good point. The feeling that there was a sort of noble and honourable tradition, particularly of Republican rebellion and resistance, certainly came into conflict with the so-called agrarian tradition of violence and intimidation, and that led to a lot of friction between the Fenians and the agrarian rebels from the 1860s onwards. And during the period that this book concerns, I think there's a movement towards coarsening, shall we say, of the conduct of the Republican movement. Now, Fergal McGarry, for example, in an early chapter in the book, discusses 1916 and finds that the rebels had a relatively clean record. In other words, they tried to adhere to what they thought was a conduct of honorable rebellion, laying down their own rules, basically. McGarry, in fact, I don't know whether he's right or not, but he puts the greater blame on the army for the killing of civilians and for acts of brutality and barbarism in 1916. And I think what you can see over the period is this sense of an honorable war conducted according to Boy Scout rules, if you like, becomes rather worn as the guerrilla campaign got underway and intensified in 1920 to 21. It became extremely difficult for either side to adhere to any a set of decent rules of combat. Now, the Republicans still believed that they were fighting a war as distinct from a rebellion, and Tom Barry is an example of somebody who was emphatic that that was what he was doing, and therefore that one must show proper consideration for prisoners and civilians, so that when he was presenting his memoir and trying to explain what he had done with the West Cork Brigade, he insists that its conduct was almost invariably honourable and in accordance with these rules, unlike the brutal, uncivilised behaviour of the auxiliaries and the soldiers that were in combat with the West Cork Brigade. Now, I think that it's an understandable point of view on Barry's part to try to draw a link between the tradition of 1916 and what was happening at Kilmichael, for example, in 1920. But it's something which is difficult to sustain when one looks closely at the evidence. And that's what Eve Morrison has done in a discussion of the famous Barry claim that there was as a result of the so-called false surrender of certain auxiliaries that they were killed when in what appeared to be a defenseless position rather than taken prisoner. That is the sort of consideration we have here, not making a judgment about the morality of Barry's conduct, but about the division between the legend that he created and the reality as it is slowly being unearthed through material such as witness statements in the Bureau of Military History, together with interviews with survivors, which have at last become available in a wider form and are no longer anonymous.
Are you surprised that there is still so much debate and so much controversy, not just about Kilmichael, but on a whole range of other issues to do with this period that attracts so many column inches? It seems to have escaped the pages of academic journals and it's now in the mainstream, people asking questions about issues like Kilmichael.
I do think it's extraordinary, certainly in international terms, that there is still such moral passion about what was going on. And of course, where you have people who believe very strongly in the morality of a certain sort of struggle, they will also believe strongly in the bad faith of those who deny that morality. And I think a lot of the bitterness which has crept into the debate recently, much of it directed against the work of my late and lamented student Peter Hart, it emerges from that. And of course, well, you then have to ask why is this still a matter of such moral importance for so many people in Ireland and beyond Ireland? The answer must be some sense that the continuing struggles in Northern Ireland were a continuation of what happened in 1916 to 23. And for many people, if that earlier conflict were tainted, if it were not seen to be an honourable war prosecuted in a noble cause in a decent fashion, that would create problems for interpretation of more recent, the more recent movement in Northern Ireland particularly. So there's certainly an element of that, but it goes far beyond that. The public interest goes well beyond those who have any particular political position about Northern Ireland. And it involves a great many people who think that the Republic has gone wrong in some way. It's become tainted. Its politicians are crooks in the pockets of developers, that they've sold their country. And I think many people are looking back to a golden age when this was not the case, when you had clean, decent revolutionaries, not tainted in the way that their hypocritical successors in politics appear to be.
Going back for a second to the 1920s, we have talked about Republican paramilitaries and what they did. What Republicans themselves argued at the time was that they were living under what Todd Andrews called tyranny tempered by assassination. What do you think about state forces? Were they guilty of terrorism in this period?
Well, I believe in many cases they were, and for much the same reason that Republicans fell into terrorism. Now, there are different sorts of terror. I mean, there's strategic terror, which is planned in advance. For example, the property reprisals conducted in the Martial Law Zone in 1921 were designed with a purpose, even though it may seem a horrible purpose. There was a logic to it. That is, that if you punish the families and shelterers of supposed Republican terrorists, then they will provide information or they will no longer provide shelter for those terrorists. So, and Lloyd George appears to have thought that you could punish communities in order to isolate the gunmen and render them vulnerable to the Crown forces. So that is strategic terror. And the same can be found on the other side with campaigns against informers, so-called. If you can punish enough, if you have enough exemplary punishments of informers, others will be afraid to pass information to the Crown forces. So that is rational terror, in a sense. But there's also the irrational terror, which results from fear and ignorance. And of course, there's no clear line between the two kinds, where actually you don't know who the informers are. You don't know who in the community is sheltering your opponents. But you suspect that you know. And that's where the danger comes, that whole villages will be punished, which are not complicit in so-called rebellion, or whole classes, such as Protestants, for example, in a locality may be punished because they're thought to be prone to become informers, even if the evidence isn't there. And it's in those conditions where you're being attacked, you know that information is leaking, that your enterprises are being foiled on both sides, that you begin to have aberrant and increasingly brutal behavior. secret assassinations by so-called anti-Sinn Féin gangs, or off-duty police being shot in the back or killed in a pub. This sort of thing. In other words, there's a psychological element to it. It's not just the psychology of fear created by the terrorist, but the psychology of insecurity which gives rise to terrorism.
I mean, if we look at the counterinsurgency throughout the period up until 1923, I think, would it be fair to say that whereas the British effort is not very successful, both the Northern Ireland and the Free State counterinsurgency are pretty successful? Would you agree with that, first of all, and why do you think that is?
Well, I think the success of a reprisal strategy or extreme coercion against targeted groups really depends on the degree to which the government is regarded as legitimate by citizens. And so you have the provisional government and the new Free State government conducting the most dreadful reprisals, I mean brutal and cynical reprisals against so-called irregulars and their supporters, but getting away with it without losing legitimacy, because it's considered that there's something worthwhile to come out of it. In other words, the use of what in normal circumstances would be seen as intolerable force, often against either the guiltless or the not very guilty, is justified by the emergency and by the widespread belief that it's worth creating a democratic state, a majoritarian state in the South. Now, I think the same applied in Northern Ireland, because after all, the result of partition was to carve up the country into two states, each of which had a very large majority, which dominated politics for decades to come. So the northern state now wasn't nearly as brutal in its suppression, if you look at the number of executions, the number of arrests and internments, as the southern state in its early days. But it was brutal enough. It too could get away with it, even get away with the punishments administered to deviant unionists and loyalists, because of the massive popular and democratic support that it had acquired.
But in relation to something like the British Army, is there a case that once you let the genie out of the bottle in regards to repressions and reprisals, like as you've spoken there and you've written about Balbriggan, is it very hard then for an army to reinforce discipline within the ranks afterwards?
Yes, I think the result of the reprisals, there were two results. One was to make it extremely difficult to conduct any sort of policing operation. The army itself was held to be less undisciplined than the paramilitary police, the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries. But undoubtedly, once these had occurred and had been condoned by superior officers in many cases, while not actually directed by any central authority, it makes it extremely difficult to get things together. Now, in the martial law zone, to some extent that was achieved in 1921. There was a distinct improvement in the performance of the Crown forces. But that was more than compensated for by the loss of legitimacy of the whole operation of the British government in Ireland. And I argue in my Balbriggan article that the result of reprisals like that was to convert non-Republican nationalists into strong opponents of British rule, because the conduct of the Crown forces seemed to be worse than that of the Republicans. And I think that, this is not simply a fiction created by Republican propaganda, although there was lots of that, it's also a fact that you have large numbers of houses, cottages being burnt down, people being attacked, one of the two big hosiery factories in Balbriggan being burnt to the ground with the loss of hundreds of jobs. All of this creates the feeling that you don't actually have a representative government at all, which is concerned with the welfare of Ireland. So my feeling is that the British government lost legitimacy over the period of the revolution by stages. And by 1921, they really had few supporters, even among so-called loyalists, and hence the strange phenomenon of peers and landlords sending articles to the reviews praising the superior performance of the Republicans compared with the so-called British government in Ireland, because at least they kept the streets clean and sent out patrols at night.
I think one of the most controversial things of all in the whole period is the question of sectarianism. It was controversial then, and it's controversial now still. One thesis that was raised by the late Peter Hart is that when the IRA looked for informers, they looked disproportionately for Protestants. And there's a good chapter in the book which says that in West Cork, that tended to be the case. What do you think of that argument?
I think that it's been somewhat overemphasized as part of Peter Hart's work. What he argued was that there were quite a number of groups which were identified by Republicans, particularly in Cork, which he studied most, as suspect. Not merely Protestants, but also travelers, army deserters, any kind of stranger was regarded as a potential threat to the national polity. There's undoubtedly an element of sectarianism in what was going on. He may have overemphasized it somewhat, but what he did pick up on, and what was one of the great novelties of his work, was just what devastating effects that could have when the lid was taken off, so to speak. In other words, his idea was that among many assumptions, deep buried most of the time, in the Irish Catholic mind, was that Protestants were really of a different stock, potentially anti-national, however much most of the time they would seem otherwise, and however well one might get on with them from day to day. And I think his study, particularly of the Dunmanway killings in April 1922, pointed to that, where you have a case where a dozen people were killed and all of them were Protestants. And the question is, why were they killed? He argued that there were all sorts of justifications which were put forward at the time. He argued, by the way, and documented this more fully than any of his adversaries, that many of them were believed to be informers, and that was a rationalization for killing them. Now, I think he probably went too far in emphasizing this sectarianism, because it's only in his broader story, it's just one of many fears and phobias that Republicans appear to have had about marginal or minority groups that weren't part of the community as they defined themselves.
Would it be fair also to say that this varies a lot from region to region in the War of Independence?
Well, undoubtedly. The kind of sectarian incidents that he described are not limited to Cork. But in every case, there is an ambiguity about the motives of those concerned. What he was talking about was much more the psychology of the killers than their conscious motivation. I doubt that any of these killings were done by people who said, I'm going to kill that person because he or she is a Protestant. It's a question of what guided the deeper process of decision-making, and that's something we can always disagree about, and passionate disagreement will continue to occur on that very topic. But the important thing is to assemble the evidence there is, put forward the case, but also provide the evidence which can refute that case. And that's what Peter Hart did in his book, with the ironic result that many of the attacks on his work are largely based on documents that he assembled himself.
Obviously, the events in Cork continue to be very controversial for a number of reasons, but something which is not talked about that much, I think, in general discourse, is that in the North, Catholics have their own story where they suffered what they considered to be a pogrom. You had incidents like the McMahon killings, where a family of six were targeted by what we think were off-duty policemen. So is that part of the story of terror in Ireland and sectarian terror?
Well, it undoubtedly is, but because this book is the work only of historians associated with Trinity, we had nobody to write about what was happening in the North. Now, there has been quite a lot of work done quite recently about this, and of course there's always the other side to the story. There's Alton of A, the killing of unprotected Protestants, as well as the McMahon murders. And Alan Parkinson, who's recently done a book on the British support for the anti-home rule movement for the war, he's also, I noticed in the paper the other day, argued that the term pogrom is unacceptable, that it's inapplicable to what was happening to Catholics in Belfast in 1920-22. That, in other words, there is not such a concerted movement as one would describe from Russian precedent as a pogrom. Rather, what you have are eruptions of violence in which paramilitaries on both sides are involved. But because of the, I suppose, what we call the demographic balance in the Belfast area, Catholics tended to suffer worse. So they're one-third of the population, but two-thirds of the victims are Catholic. Now, that's something I would have liked to have had, an impartial dissection of that two-way movement of terror that occurred in Ulster.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our interview. Thank you very much, Professor Dave Fitzpatrick. The book is Terror in Ireland, 1916 to 1923, from the Trinity History Workshop, and that is published by Lilliput Press. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you very much.
Hello and welcome to Near 90 FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and this week I'm very pleased to be joined by Dr. Micheál Ócsócrú. Dr. Ócsócrú is a lecturer in early modern Irish history in Trinity College Dublin. He has written extensively on Ireland in the 1640s and presented Cromwell in Ireland for RTÉ Television. Dr. Ócsócrú, welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Colin.
On today's show, we're going to talk about the 1641 rebellion in Ireland. To put it in context, what was the political situation in Ireland leading up to 1641, and what do you think were the causes of the rebellion?
Well, it was a time of great tension, actually, in the three Stuart kingdoms as they're known, England, Scotland and Ireland. Charles I, the king, had a very authoritarian streak, if you like, and was into centralising his three kingdoms and bringing a sense of uniformity, both politically and religiously, to three very, very diverse kingdoms. And this caused a huge amount of tension and problems right across his realm. Ireland itself, of course, was a place with great tensions. They had simply completed the conquest of Ireland at the end of the 9 Years' War in 1603, and this was followed subsequently, of course, by the Ulster Plantation. Now, the Ulster Plantation resulted in the large-scale dispossession of the native Irish lords and landholders and the imposition of Protestant settlers, both from England and Scotland. And this, not surprisingly, caused quite a lot of resentment and tensions in the native Irish community. So in many ways, it was not necessarily a place about to blow, but it wouldn't have taken much, as it turned out, for the whole kingdom to go up in flames, as indeed happened with the outbreak of the rebellion in October 1641. Now, it was probably an interesting mix, if you like, of both the long-term grievances that the native Irish had, politically and religiously, being excluded from their lands, being excluded from the political community in the Kingdom of Ireland. But also there was more short-term issues at stake here as well. There were a number of poor harvests led to economic difficulties, and there were religious and political tensions in England which also affected the situation in Ireland. And Irish Catholics in particular were very afraid that the anti-Catholic policies which were being put to the fore in Scotland and England would be brought over to an even greater degree than they had already into Ireland. And so what you had was a group of existing landowners in Ulster who decided, if you like, to make a preemptive strike to try and take control of the kingdom very quickly with as little bloodshed as possible and from a position of strength to force concessions from King Charles I. And this is what the initial plan was all about. They were going to seize Dublin Castle, the administrative centre of the Kingdom of Ireland, and at the same time seize key strongholds across Ulster to cut the Protestant settlers off from Dublin and prevent both sides, if you like, from helping each other. The first part of the plan, the seizing of certain strongholds in Ulster, went extremely well. And on the night of the 22nd of October, I should say, they seized Charlemont Fort and a number of other places in South Ulster. The plan to take Dublin Castle, however, was a disastrous failure. The authorities found out at the last minute and the ringleaders were rounded up in the city here in Dublin, imprisoned. And so right throughout the war, which went on for the next 12 years, the rebels never managed to capture the city of Dublin, and this was a major, major setback to their plans.
Some of the rebels mentioned that they took their inspiration from Scotland, or the Scots taught their ABCs. What did they mean when they said that?
Well, with the Scots, you had a group known as the Covenanters, who I suppose in our parlance today would be Presbyterians, and they disliked in particular the religious policies of Charles I, who was an Anglican, and wanted to impose a certain religious uniformity on the Scots. And in an attempt to prevent this, the Scottish Covenanters seized control very quickly of the Kingdom of Scotland in 1638 and set up their own regime. And for many Irish Catholics living across the Irish Sea, this seemed like, if you like, the ideal way to go about trying to get concessions from the king. And they hoped to do, as I say, something similar with this very quick preemptive strike in October 1641.
Some of the rebels, they were described as the deserving Irish. What's that phrase mean?
Well, the interesting thing about the rebellion is that you'd expect that it would be led by the very people who'd been driven off their lands, many of them into exile. And indeed, there were Irish, particularly in Spanish Flanders at the time, who were looking for an opportunity to come home to Ireland, regain their lands and to drive the English out. But the actual initial rebellion was led by these people, as you term them, and they were termed at the time, the deserving Irish. And these were people who had actually received some lands during the Ulster Plantation. They were considered to be loyal enough, or at least not enough of a threat, that they could be given some lands. And it was hoped by the English authorities at the time that by living in close proximity to English and Scottish Protestant settlers, that they would, in English terms, become civilised over the forthcoming decades. The problem was that these deserving Irish found it very difficult to accommodate themselves to the new regime. Many of them quickly fell into debt trying to maintain their farms and lands along English lines economically. And not only that, but the lands they received were often far from their own birthplace where they expected to be, and they were very unhappy with the allocations that they had received. So it was actually this small group of deserving Irish who led the initial rebellion. However, very quickly, the rebellion gets out of control. With the failure of the preemptive strike, we have a two-tier rising. And the second stage of the rising is more a populist uprising, where the decades of resentment at the treatment of the native Irish and of Irish Catholics in general, and the short-term economic difficulties that were being experienced at the time, led to a nationwide rebellion in which the small group who had led the initial rising very quickly lost control. And that's what happened, is a more general uprising, which now is something very, very different than that had been initially planned.
Now, when you were talking about the native Irish and the Gaelic Irish, could you describe the ethnic fault line among Irish Catholics at the time?
Well, yeah, Ireland is very much a sort of place of great ethnic mix, if you like, at this time. We have, of course, the native Irish, who have been there for a long time, of course, who almost exclusively have remained Catholic. But we also have the original English colonists. These are people who'd arrived over with the first Norman invasion in the late 12th and early 13th centuries. And they had, for the most part, retained a certain amount of their own identity. But with the break between England and Rome in the 16th century, this original group of colonists, the Anglo-Irish, or the Old English as they became known, they retained their Catholicism. And as such, they began to drift, if you like, from the motherland, so to speak, where they were seen as religiously suspect by the English authorities, and therefore, as far as they were concerned, could not be trusted with any political power. And this, for the Old English, who saw themselves as the natural ruling class throughout much of Ireland, was a huge source of resentment. And when the rebellion breaks out, very quickly it becomes apparent to the Irish Catholics, both native Irish and Old English, that the English are simply not prepared to distinguish between them or discriminate between them. They decide to treat all Irish Catholics, regardless of their ethnic background, simply as Irish Catholics. And therefore, the Old English and Native Irish, who have been enemies in many ways for centuries, join together in 1641-42 to fight together for their rights, religiously and politically. And they set up what's known as the Confederate Association, based in the city of Kilkenny.
Would it be right to describe them as nationalist rebels? Would that be a correct term to use?
Well, I think the way we look at nationalism today is we tend to think of it in very much in a modern context, post the French Revolution in 1789. But there's no question that the Old English and the Native Irish at this stage, because of how they're being treated, are beginning to form a common identity. And that common identity is an Irish Catholic identity. So to that sense, they are aware of, if you like, the Irish nation and of Ireland as a separate political entity. So we can, to some degree, call them nationalists. However, it's very important to stress that at no stage they seek to break the link with King Charles I. King Charles I was King of Ireland as well as King of England and Scotland, and they were happy to try and reach some form of accommodation with that king. They were not separatists. They didn't want to set up an independent Ireland, but at the same time, I would call them nationalists.
Now, just touching on that subject, why was there such a depth of loyalty to the Stuarts, considering the policies of Charles and his father as well before him?
That's an interesting question. I mean, there is a great sense of, if you like, loyalty to the king, because obviously if you go into rebellion, the consequences are great if you lose, and most early modern rebellions are failures. And the consequence of that is usually you're executed, you lose your lands, your families are driven away. So it's a very, very serious step to go into rebellion. So I think at all times during the 1640s, the Irish Catholics were anxious not to be termed as rebels, that they saw themselves that they had their issues with the king. Yes, there was things that had to be resolved, but they at the same time always described themselves as loyal subjects. Why were they loyal to the Stuarts? Well, I mean, there's numerous books written about this and various people have speculated about it. On one level, they saw the Stuarts going back through time as originally Gaelic or Gaelic as well, that they had a long tradition going back centuries in Scotland, and so that there was some affinity, if you like, between the Stuart family and the Gaelic Irish. As well as that, King James VI and I, who was the one who, if you like, brought together the three kingdoms, his mother was, of course, Mary, Queen of Scots, and she was a great Catholic martyr as well. So even though James and his son, Charles I, were Protestants, there was a feeling that beneath it all, there was some residual sympathy for Catholics. And if only this could be brought out, that the Catholics would fare much better under the Stuarts than they ever had under the Tudor monarchies.
Well, talking of the rebellion in the context of the War of the Three Kingdoms, how did events in England with regards to parliamentarians and the king, how does that affect or maybe speed up actions in Ireland towards rebellion?
Well, I mean, I think one of the great problems for Irish Catholics was that they're looking over at England and they can see that king and parliament are increasingly at loggerheads. The English parliament is much more anti-Catholic. There's a strong strain of Puritanism there. And they're afraid that if parliament gains the upper hand in the conflict between king and parliament, that ultimately it's Irish Catholics who will pay. So they, in a sense, want to support the king in his struggle against Parliament, hoping that a sort of generous king or a grateful king at the end of any conflict will be prepared to make concessions to Irish Catholics. Now, interestingly, it's actually the outbreak of the Irish Rebellion in October 1641 that ultimately leads to the outbreak of the English Civil War the following August between king and Parliament, because the great issue with the outbreak of the Irish Rebellion is who should control the English army that's sent over to crush the rebels. And Parliament doesn't want to give control of that army to the king because they don't trust him, and vice versa. And this is one of the issues. It's not the key issue between king and Parliament, but it is the issue that finally breaks the relationship between the two and leads to the outbreak of the English Civil War, as I said, a few months later.
Was there a belief, maybe a false belief, but was there a belief that King Charles had actually initiated a rebellion in Ireland or was trying to use it for political purposes?
Well, I mean, Charles I was a slippy character by any means or by any ways of calculating it. We're never quite sure what he was about. He had he had secret contacts all over the place. He was constantly plotting and planning. But it seems the evidence seems to suggest that he in no way was involved with the plans for rebellion in Ireland. But because of his past and because of the way he had operated, it was very easy for his enemies in England to portray it as if this had been the plan of the king all along. And this was aided by the fact that the rebels in Ireland called themselves loyal subjects of the king. And for that reason, this was one of the big charges against Charles I, that he was actually secretly colluding with Irish Catholics. And for English Protestants, that was probably the greatest crime of all.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the rebels failed to take Dublin. How important was Dublin to a successful rebellion?
Dublin was the key to the rebellion in many ways. It was the administrative centre of the kingdom. It was, if you like, the engine room of the English colonial effort in Ireland. And the failure to take Dublin really left the rebels in a very weak position. From Dublin, the English were able to launch their counter-offensive, which they did fairly quickly. A large number of supplies, both men and weapons, start to come over from England. And we have a number of commanders from Dublin who head out into the city and the wider area around it, launching indiscriminate attacks against the native Irish. and indeed Irish Catholics in general. There's a number of very famous incidences that take place in Santry and Clontarf at the hands of probably one of the most notorious commanders of the age, a man called Sir Charles Coote. And Coote was greatly feared by Irish Catholics. He absolutely hated them. He was a terrible bigot. And he made no distinction between rebels and ordinary civilians. And he sweeps into Clontarf, into Santry, killing all around him. And there's no question but that these attacks by Coote and others from Dublin helped to spread the rebellion. We also have a very famous massacre down at Carrick Mines Castle at the end of the M50 now. Unfortunately, most of it has been swept away with the arrival of the new motorway, where again, when the castle is stormed, everybody within it, including civilians, women and children, are killed. So even in the immediate vicinity of the city of Dublin, the Irish Catholics suffer grievous losses very, very early on. And as I say, Dublin serves as an entrepot then for supplies for men to come over from England to help crush the rebellion. And of course, it's in 1649 that Oliver Cromwell himself uses Dublin as the launching pad for his invasion, which finally brings the war to an end after an incredibly bloody 4 years of conquest by 1653. So there's no question but that Dublin is absolutely central to what's going on here. And if the rebels had succeeded in taking Dublin, I think it would have been a very, very different rebellion. We have the example of the Scots, as we mentioned, taking over the entire kingdom of Scotland, including the capital, Edinburgh. And that leaves them in a much stronger position to resist any incursion from outside. But the Irish rebels don't have that luxury because of the failure to take the castle. Now, there's many stories about failing to take the castle, and really a lot of it is down to myth and stories that have come down through the age. But what seems to have happened, as so often is the case among rebellions that have been planned in Ireland, is that there was a traitor in their midst. A man called Owen O'Connolly, who was very close to Lord Maguire, one of the key rebels. And he gets away from the rebels on the evening before the attack is due to take place, gets the authorities. He's a lot of difficulty convincing them that there actually is a rebellion about to take place. They have no idea. They've been absolutely successful until then in keeping it secret. But it's his intervention and the subsequent arrest of the leaders all around the city of Dublin that evening and following morning that means that the attempt to take Dublin Castle fails.
Well, an interesting what if in Irish history.
Well, I think Irish history is full of what ifs, and we can never know exactly what might have happened. But there's no question that the English would have tried to get back to Ireland anyway. It's not that it would have meant no English invasion. But without Dublin as a launching pad, it would have been extremely difficult for them to do so, and probably would have prolonged the whole war by a number of years if the rebels had held Dublin itself.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier was that the rebellion in its early phases started to lose control, the leaders started to lose control of the rebellion. Could you talk about a very controversial issue, the massacres of Protestants or planter civilians in Ulster?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of obviously the most controversial episodes of the entire war that takes place from 1641 through to 1653. And that first initial 6 to 12 months of the rebellion, there were serious allegations of a systematic and widespread slaughter of the Protestant community in Ireland, particularly in the Ulster counties. Now, we have to look very carefully at this because we have to try and separate, if you like, fact from fiction, propaganda from reality. And there's no doubt that a large number of Protestant settlers were killed, but nothing like the numbers that were being reported in England. It became a widely accepted figure in England within about 6 months of the rebellion breaking out that as many as 150,000 Protestant settlers had been slaughtered. Now that exceeds by 50,000 the total Protestant population in Ireland at this time. So that number is clearly nonsense. Mm. But it reflected to some degree the panic that was felt in England on news of the outbreak of the Irish Rebellion, and also the way in which propagandists tried to exploit this conflict to denigrate the king and to try and whip up this kind of anti-Catholic, anti-Irish hysteria, which was very prevalent throughout the subsequent war. Recent research suggests that the numbers killed probably were in the region of about 4,000 to 5,000, which is a very significant number and should in no way limit the horrors of this period. Very large numbers of people were killed. But what's often forgotten is that similar numbers of Catholics were also killed in indiscriminate government reprisals during those early months of the rebellion, as the government in Dublin decided to take advantage of the rebellion to strike out in general at the Catholic population, and in particular at the Catholic landowning classes. And it was the government reprisals more than anything else which helped spread the rebellion. Because as far as Irish Catholics were concerned, they were now all targets. And if they were all being targeted, they may as well take up arms and try and defend themselves against this colonial administration, which seemed incapable or unwilling to discriminate between rebels and loyal Catholic subjects.
How much do you think the effect of the massacres, or what they were perceived to be, fed into Ulster Protestant identity?
There's no question that the outbreak of the rebellion and the subsequent killings, particularly over the first year, had a huge impact on the Ulster Protestant community. And we can still see that today. If you look at the Orange Marches, there were a number of banners representing certain events that took place during the early months of the rebellion, particularly the massacre at Portadown Bridge, when up to 100 men, women and children were driven into the River Bann and drowned or shot if they tried to get out of the river. And these helped, if you like, bring together this Protestant community, which in some ways had been very divided between English and Scottish Protestant settlers. They now began to, if you like, develop this sense of common identity in the face of a native Catholic threat. And we start to get the use of the term British, interestingly enough, in Ulster during this period, as they try to get over their own ethnic divisions between English and Scottish to join together in a common British Protestant identity. And this is something that, as we know here in Ireland, is something that carried on and continues to carry on 350 years later. So the 1641 rebellion played a hugely important and crucial role in the development of that identity.
Now, could you tell us about the project you're working on at the moment in regards to the 1641 depositions? And maybe just ask first, what were the 1641 depositions?
Well, 1641 depositions were based on a government commission, which was brought together in December 1641, so just 2 months after the rebellion. And these commissioners were to take witness statements from refugees fleeing, particularly from Ulster, but not just from Ulster, from other parts of Ireland as well, most of whom were coming to Dublin seeking refuge. And initially it started out as an inventory of loss, that they would simply list off what they had lost as a result of the rebellion, with the idea that when the rebellion was put down, that they could be compensated for those losses. So the first depositions really just list off things like, you know, 4 cows, 10 plates, you know, whatever food, furniture, etc. they might have had in their houses. But very quickly, as news of killings start to trickle into Dublin as well, the commissioners decide to use the depositions to start accumulating evidence against the rebels, which will be used in trials once the rebellion is over. So we start to get accounts of killings that are allegedly taking place across Ireland. Some of them unquestionably did take place. A lot of the evidence, however, is based on, if you like, not on eyewitness accounts, but on second or third hand information. And of course, then it is multiplied when it heads over to London and is used by printers and publishers in London to sell news sheets with lurid tales of the atrocities carried out by the Catholic Irish. And this fits in very neatly with the English view of the world at this time, where the great enemy is seen as global Catholicism, if you like, of European-wide Catholicism, led, of course, by France and Spain, traditional enemies of the English. And now this is tied in with the native Irish into this sort of global, sort of Catholic conspiracy that's out there to destroy English Protestantism completely. And so it unquestionably feeds into the prejudices that already exist within English society against the Irish and against Catholicism in general.
And could you maybe discuss the project that's going on now at the moment in Trinity College in relation to the depositions?
Well, they end up taking about 4,000 of these statements, and they're absolutely remarkable documents because, if you like, this is a window into everyday society, which for the 17th century is almost unparalleled. We don't get anything like this anywhere else in Europe, indeed, at this time. We're getting the ordinary people speaking their voice, telling us what happened to them during this crucial period in Irish history. Now, this runs to about 20,000 manuscript pages, so it's an absolutely enormous collection that's contained in about 30 volumes or so here in Trinity College. And it has probably been central to one of the most contested allegations, this allegation which I mentioned before of a systematic general massacre of the Protestant population. But because the collection is so huge, and also it's very difficult to read, there's a number of different hands that are quite difficult to read, the manuscripts themselves are in poor condition. So what we're doing in Trinity at the moment is transcribing and digitizing this entire collection. And this will go online starting at the end of this year in December, and the full collection will be online by the end of 2010. It'll be open access, so members of the public can access it as well. It covers the 32 counties of Ireland. It covers thousands of different people and their life experience. And it's an absolutely unique and fascinating source, not only for historians, but for linguists, for genealogists, and indeed for the general public who might want to look up their families or their regions and see what's going on. So once we have this open and ready for people to look at, I believe it's going to transform the way we look at 17th century history. It'll give people access to the type of sources that really just aren't available anywhere else.
Dr. Shukru, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.